The Guardian.
The festive season is fast approaching, so this year, while you're busy buying gifts for friends and family, why not treat yourself too? This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the simple yet powerful all-in-one website building platform. With Squarespace, you can easily create your own website for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog. It's simple, and it'll be the one gift you know you won't want to return. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Ian Sample. Coming up on the show, do scientists stop for Christmas? Is halibut an obligatory festive food if you're in Nuuk, Greenland? We speak to the researchers in the furthest reaches of the planet to find out about the projects they're working on and what the conditions are like. We'll hear from scientists in Antarctica and Sudan, in Greenland, the Arctic, and even on a remote research vessel in the Indian Ocean. Also on the show, we look at our favourite science stories of the year, including gravitational waves, the triumph of Rosetta, and infusions of young blood to rejuvenate the old. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Joining me in the studio are the Observer's science editor, Robin McKee, and Nicola Davis, commissioning editor of Observer Tech Monthly. Welcome to you both.
Hello.
Hi.
Let's have a zip through our stories of 2014 to kick off with. Who wants to start? Robin, you're taking the floor, by the looks of things.
Age before beauty. Yes, I see. Very good, thank you. I'm going to give two, but my main one is a terribly obvious one. It's the discovery by Rosetta, Rosina device, that the hydrogen deuterium ratios on comet 67P are very unlike those of Earth. Many more deuterium atoms in their ratio. Strong indicator that at least comets of this type are not responsible for providing the water that makes up our oceans at the moment. It's just one discovery by Rosetta. It's been up there for about 3 or 4 months. There are a swathe of papers in print now going through referees. This was the first one out just a couple of weeks ago, and it's an indication not only of a great event that happened last year, but an indication of what a tremendous event we're going to get next year. More papers coming out, and then as the comet reaches its perihelion in August, it's just going to be a complete firework. Absolutely fantastic science and a fantastic display. So, I mean, hats off to the European Space Agency, a tremendous triumph for them. And, the next few months are going to be even better. And as to my second one, I just got to say something about the discovery in Canada, in the northern waters of Canada, of the lost ship of John Franklin. Probably the greatest and most mysterious expedition loss in polar research. And after years of looking, they found this boat in perfect condition. And again, over the next few years, as they bring things out. And I was at a talk recently at the British Library, which Ryan Harris, the man in charge, showed us photographs. They've got the ship's bell out and everything already. We're going to see some tremendous stuff. Franklin's body could still be in that boat. We could discover exactly what went on to this fantastically well-equipped expedition that nevertheless, from which every single person died. So these are my discoveries of the year. It's been a good year.
Hear, hear. Nicola, what was yours?
Well, I think it's slightly controversially, perhaps. It's the story of the gravitational waves. So just a quick recap, BICEP 2, the telescope at the South Pole, thought that the researchers there thought that they had managed to detect these gravitational waves, often described as sort of ripples in space-time, which tell us or could tell us about the Big Bang and cosmic inflation. So it's sort of very exciting discovery. It was hailed as, you know, the discovery of a lifetime, you know, Nobel Prize winning stuff. And it was extremely exciting. Everyone got, you know, really onto this. These results were announced at a big press conference. And then, of course, only a matter of weeks, months later, it all turned to dust, quite literally. It turned out that these discoveries might actually not be gravitational or marks or signatures of gravitational waves at all, but down to dust. And it was sort of an anticlimax, disappointment, bit of a deflation, if you will, which was quite sad. But actually, what I like about this story is that it's a really great way of people kind of feeling like they're in there with the scientific process, you know? People think they've made a discovery and then more information comes along and that discovery turns out to be something a bit different. And sometimes that can be something even more exciting. Sometimes it can be a bit of an anticlimax. And I think what I really liked about this story was that people got excited and people were wanting to know what gravitational waves were. And they, you know, were following the story and they were following the experience of the scientists. And I really liked that.
We should say it's not, they've not totally ruled out their data show this. It's just that the cosmic dust that's out there could explain everything they've seen. Exactly. So at the moment, it's kind of a huge question mark hanging over
that study. There's still tantalising questions to be answered there.
It's also worth saying that it's a very good demonstration of the scientific process in action. And then someone, a scientist, comes up with something and then it's tested and tested and tested. And in this case, it's not quite passing the test, though it might still. But in the long run, when a scientist has put through these things, and they say, actually, we're pretty sure about it. You're damn sure they're sure about
exactly.
it. And people who are climate change deniers, and if there's any of these idiots listening to us, go away. They should realise when a scientist says something, it's not just a sort of put-up job. They're trying to knock each other's stories down. Mm. And if it stands, it's damn good. And the Earth is heating up.
They're welcome to listen. This is an interesting show for everybody, whatever they are thinking about the world. Surely, Robin, the inclusivity of science. But anyway, before you have time to answer... The story that caught my eye, among a zillion this year, was there were a flurry of papers that all came out on the same day, on a Sunday this year, and they were from Harvard and Stanford groups, and they all showed that if you infuse blood from young animals into older animals, and this was done in mice, as a lot of these early studies are, you could get rejuvenating effects in the older animals. It's been pulled out as one of the sort of 10 breakthrough studies of the year by Science Magazine. And I think it's just a really fascinating and intriguing one, this, because they're now looking to see what it is in blood plasma that is or that might be doing this. And they've seen improvements in the brain, in muscles, skeletal muscles, in the heart and other organs. Pretty much everything they've looked at, they've seen that this stuff seems to, somewhere in that young plasma is something that seems to be doing some kind of repair or what have you in the older animals' bodies. And what's interesting about it is it's already gone into a very early type of a kind of experimental trial. At Stanford, that will probably not tell us too much at this early stage, but that work is moving on pretty quickly to find out what is it in that plasma that's having these effects and does it obviously have any impact in humans. So I think it's just one to watch for next year because we'll be seeing a lot more work on that area because it doesn't involve a lot of technical work, particularly to do that. You can start analysing this plasma and trying to find the compounds in it to see what effect they might have. So that's the one I would pick out. As part of this festive special of Science Weekly, we wanted to talk to scientists in far-flung places around the world, just to show that science continues come whatever, but also to give a flavour of the kinds of science that are being done around the world. We start off with the colder parts of the world. We interviewed three scientists working on the ice caps to see what they'll be up to over Christmas.
Let's kick off with Beth Healy, who's out in Antarctica, where she says that she'll certainly be having a white Christmas this year.
Well, I'm in Concordia in Antarctica, which is on Dome Sea, which is one of the plateaus on the in Antarctica, so it's inland base. And it's a French-Italian base.
You're doing research with the ESA, is that right?
Yeah, so I'm working for the European Space Agency, and Concordia is regarded as a spaceflight analogue, which basically means that it's got a lot of similarities to space travel, because we have isolation, we've got low oxygen levels because we're at altitude, and also we have a long period of darkness during the overwinter period. So these are the three main things that we're considering with the research that we're doing when I'm out here.
Fantastic. And what is it you're actually doing? Give me an idea of your day-to-day sort of work. What is it you're looking at?
So all the experiments are being done on the crew that are doing the overwinter here in Concordia. So we're looking mainly at the isolation, so the psychology surrounding that, but also the low oxygen levels, so the hypoxia. So we've got a few experiments and looking at how we're acclimatising when we first arrive here. We're also looking at the low light levels during the overwinter period. So we're looking at sleep-wake cycles and looking at activities using actigraphs. So basically it's a watch that we're wearing for the entire overwinter period. So it looks at our activity levels and how that might change. We've done sort of functional MRI scans before and after the overwinter period as well, so seeing if there's any structural changes.
And can you just give me a feel for what it's like living there in Antarctica? Can you tell me what it's like when you look outside and what the environment is like? Because I'm sure that our listeners would love to know, what's it like spending time out there?
Okay, so we're on one of the inland bases. So we're up on the plateau, and so it's incredibly dry. At the moment, we're having 24-hour sunlight because it's the summer period. The temperatures, we're having a sort of minus 35 to minus 50 during the summer period. Yeah, I mean, it's a small group of us out here, so we're living very closely together. I'm on a French-Italian base, so lots of different languages and cultures going on as well. So that adds an exciting part, especially for Christmas, all different Christmas traditions all coming together. So
I wanted to ask you a little bit there about what is it that you're going to be doing. Are you going to be doing any research on Christmas Day, or are you guys taking the day off?
Definitely taking the day off, I think, for Christmas Day. Lots of fun to go outside in the snow, making snowmans, and, well, we're making an igloo in preparation for Christmas Day as well, so hopefully we'll go out and have some time in that. We've got a fantastic chef as well, so I'm looking forward to Christmas dinner with the food that he's making. And we've just prepared some limoncello as well from the Italian side, so looking forward to cracking that open as well.
And when are you coming back to the UK? When do you get the chance to head back?
So not until after the overwinter period, so we're looking at between 9 to 12 months probably. Wow. Until I get back to England, so a long time.
Do you get a chance to go outside much in the base though, or do you tend to stay inside to do all your research?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we go out most days. The weather's actually incredibly good here, although it's quite cold. It's always very sunny during the summer period. So I go out and help with the glaciologists digging holes and taking ice samples, sort of ice cores. So yeah, we get out a lot. We have lots of planes coming in during the summer as well, with bringing in more summer crews. So we go out and help.
Well, my name's Mary Sims. I'm a meteorologist. And I work for the British Antarctic Survey at Rothera Research Station in Antarctica.
So tell me what the place is like down there. Take us through what the landscape looks like. Who are you down there with?
Okay, so the base is situated on a small peninsula on Adelaide Island. It's just off the west coast of the main Antarctic peninsula. It's a really beautiful place. It's surrounded by mountains and islands and sea. And depending on sort of the weather conditions and the time of the year, the sea can be filled with icebergs and ice, or completely open. And so the seascape can change within a matter of hours if the wind changes direction or strength.
Mary, what's it like in terms of sunlight down there? Do you actually see much darkness?
At the moment, it's 24-hour sunlight. The sun failed to set late November, and it won't set again until sort of mid-January. So we've got 24 hours of sunlight at the moment. I think it messes with some people's body clocks. I think people sort of go to sleep later and wake up a bit earlier. And it doesn't feel like you need as much sleep as you do, you know, when it is dark, which is quite good for working hours. It is quite funny, you know, if you've been having a late drink in the bar, a late evening meal, and you come out and you know, you expect it to be dark, but of course it isn't. So, you know, 3 o'clock in the morning, it's still light. So yeah, it's strange about that, but it's nice as well because you get all the different light effects, you know, on the mountains and the sea and the icebergs. You get some gorgeous colors with the sunlight being out all the time when it's not cloudy, of course.
Take us through like a typical day. What do you actually do as a meteorologist down there?
Okay, so in the summer, which it is at the moment, there's a lot of aircraft flying around getting scientists into the field. So I work as part of a MET team. There are three of us, meteorological team, and a big part of our role is to provide the aircraft with weather observations for flight safety primarily. So we'll go up to the ops tower and have a wonderful panoramic view of the scenery and sort of gauge visibilities and cloud bases from all the lovely mountains that are around us. We also do observations that get sent off to the Met Office so that they can ingest them into their weather and climate models. We release weather balloons 4 times a week in the mornings. We release the balloons and they go off up through the atmosphere and taking measurements as they go up, sometimes getting up to sort of 25 kilometres high before they burst. And also they say the balloon sort of gets up to the size of a double-decker bus before it pops. It's So it's nice to see them getting released and floating off into the atmosphere. In the summer as well, we fly off to different automatic weather stations that are based around the peninsula, and we service them. We just make sure all the instruments are working and they've got power. So that's a really interesting part of our job, getting off base and flying around and seeing the lovely different parts of the peninsula and the lovely scenery.
How's life different in that community you're living in now?
We're definitely part of a community. Not only do we do our own jobs, but we also have to help each other out. Everybody needs help in their own job. We're also our own emergency services. So, you know, we take on roles of medics, firefighters. We need to be able to know how to deal with oil spill situations. We need to be able to refuel planes. Some of us get trained up to be competent crew so that we can go out with the marine biologists and the boatmen and help them out when they're diving or collecting water samples. So there's a lot of variety of jobs that we have to take on, not only, you know, our own work role. So yeah, so there is definitely a community feel. We all depend on each other for our work, but also like emotionally as well, being so far from friends and family. You also have to sort of comfort people when they need it, and also know when to leave people alone when they want to be left alone. So that's really quite important, and I think that takes time, just getting to know people and know the differences and different characteristics of what people, you know, how people adjust and what sort of emotional support people need.
What does Christmas Day look like at the base? What sort of things will you be getting up to?
So Christmas Day, because we're in flat bang in the middle of our summer season, it's really still quite busy. If there is a lovely day weather-wise, there probably will be flying going on, and that involves a lot of people, not just pilots, you know, comms people, the Met, the meteorological team. So it could be treated as a normal working day. But having said that, the decorations are up in the communal areas. The chefs have set aside some really nice food apparently for a Christmas meal. I'm sure there'll be Christmas carols on the day and possibly a mince pie and a glass of mulled wine. So we do tend to celebrate Christmas, but we don't get the big build-up like we do back in the UK.
My name is Hunter Snyder, and I'm an anthropologist and a filmmaker working in Greenland in Nuuk in the capital, with support from the National Geographic Young Explorer Program and the Fulbright Commission. And I'm here studying indigenous livelihoods such as hunting and fishing amid industrialization and proposed large-scale mining activity.
Tell me a bit about the place you're in right now. I've no idea whereabouts sort of in Greenland you are, what the landscape is like there, what the people are like you're working with.
Well, even though it's December and we're thinking a lot about Christmas, there are no trees here. I'm actually at the 64-degree line, just 2 degrees below the Arctic Circle. And right now, the weather today is especially beautiful. We have some sun, which is a little bit of an anomaly these days. Unfortunately, it's not setting on the town so much, but we can see it off into the distance. It's quite a wintry wonderland here.
Do you get much daylight this time of year?
There is some daylight from about 10 until 2:30, 3 o'clock, and then it gets dark. And right now we are in the darkest months as we approach the winter solstice.
Give me some idea of the landscape there. Are you in a town or a village or what?
Yeah, so I'm here in Nuuk, which is the capital of Greenland. And a lot of people say that when you come to Greenland, there is Nuuk and there is Greenland, which is in some ways to distinguish Nuuk as some place that is not like the rest of Greenland at all. And as you walk around and you see the architecture, it does in fact feel very different from the pictures that you see of the small villages throughout the rest of the country. There are places within the town, however, that do carry that same sort of architecture and feeling of the Greenland that we might all know from images that we see in the news and the like.
Tell us about the community there and how you're working with them. What do you go out and do each day? What are you looking for in your work?
Well, my assumption in coming here was that, which is maybe the case for a lot of people, is that things here work a lot differently than they do in other parts of the world, that in some ways Greenland is a far-flung location on the map, and as such, the way that people work in the fishing industry are also very different and very simple or basic. But it's actually not that way at all. In fact, what you see here in Greenland is that the indigenous people and the large companies are employing the same kinds of technology that we would see in other places like Spain or in New England. And when I speak with people about the importance of using new technology, they don't think twice about it. It's part of what they do here. And when I see people interacting with mobile phones and social media, in fact, many of them are more connected than I even am, despite having a Facebook and a Twitter account. When you come here, you think that what you will see is something entirely exotic and completely different from what happens in the UK or in the United States. And it's, in fact, very, very similar. And the same is actually the case when we think about Christmas traditions as well.
Let us in on what you're going to be doing for Christmas this year. Is it going to be, you're going to be out there working, I presume?
Yeah, I will be here working. I'm spending most of my time down in the harbor with the fishermen during the daytime, but I will break away for a more standard Christmas holiday. I have some company here. My girlfriend has come to visit me from the United States, which further verifies the ease with which one can travel here, although it did take 3 days. But I will be having a fairly traditional Christmas. I have some friends here and we'll be making a pork roast and something like that. But I must admit that my colleagues who focus on Greenlandic cuisine would be horrified if I mentioned that that's what everyone does. But it is definitely something that one can do here. We have access to most of the same things that you might in the Sainsbury's or Waitrose.
What do you think the rest of the people in the city will be doing? What are the other things that will be going on Christmas Day where you are?
Well, there are strong traditions to visit the church on Christmas Eve on the morning, although most folks have to get up quite early for that, 6:30, 7 o'clock, because of the space constraints. In addition, you have people wandering around enjoying the Christmas lights. Again, we do have quite a lot of darkness, so there are plenty of Christmas stars in the windows of every home and building, and there are several Christmas trees that are erected throughout the town that are lit. And most people will go out for a walk or spend time inside with their families and friends. And many of the people that are living in Nuuk that are from Greenland will actually be traveling to the smaller settlements or back to Denmark to see family and friends.
So that was Hunter Snyder doing his Christmas shop up north. Now, let's try going somewhere a bit warmer. Christmas, of course, is all about traditions, all about the past. You know, a lot of things that we do the same every year. And really digging into the past this year at Christmas is Derek Wellesby, who's out in the Sudan on an archaeological dig.
Well, I'm actually in a village called Kasura, which is in the northern part of Sudan. We're about 2 miles from the banks of the Nile. Living in a small village, we rent a house from a local man. So we have a nice house here, a big courtyard.
And can you tell me a bit about the project, so the excavation you're working on at the moment?
Well, we are working on a site called Kawa, which was a major town founded probably by Akhenaten and then occupied for about 2,000 years afterwards. And we're excavating in the town and also excavating in the cemeteries, excavating the graves, a number of which are marked on the surface by pyramids.
And what does it involve? What's the day-to-day life like on the dig?
Well, we work here 6 days a week. We have a group of 9 people from outside of Sudan, professional archaeologists, and we employ about 50 local workmen on the site. So we get to site before the storm comes up. We work through until about 1:30, at which point it's too hot, really, to carry on working. And then we go back to work at 4 o'clock when it's beginning to cool down. We work then until sunset, which is about 6:30 here at the moment.
What have you been finding from the site? What's the latest discoveries that you've been unearthing, quite literally?
Well, the most exciting things we're finding are in the cemetery, stone pyramids dating from around the beginning of our era. And these are of the sort of quality that elsewhere in Sudan are only used to mark burials of kings and queens of Kush from the 9th century BC until the 4th century AD. So these are very special things to find at a place like Kawa.
And what will you be doing then on Christmas Day? So you're going to be out there throughout the festive period. What's Christmas Day looking like for you?
Well, Christmas Day is usual. We're out here every Christmas year on year. So we go off to the big town in Dongola, where we go for a local breakfast. We have people breakfast, which is fool, that's Egyptian beans with cheese. And we also have this special sort of fish called fasik, which is salted fish. It's very tasty.
And then will you be going up to the site at all and doing anything on the dig?
We don't go on site on Christmas Day, no. We have just 1 day off a week, so we organise it so that Christmas Day is that day off. And then, of course, 7 days later, our next day off is on New Year's Day, so we have that off as well.
And are there going to be any nods to Western Christmas? Are you going to have Christmas jumpers on or anything of that sort? Is it just too hot?
We try and have a Christmas dinner. So we buy some chickens in the local town, and we have a local Sudanese cook, and he produces a nice chicken Christmas dinner for us. And the only thing we actually bring out from the UK is Christmas pudding, so we will have a Christmas pudding.
Also enjoying the sun this year, Katie Collier is out in South Africa, where she's going to be spending the festive period with some rather small furry friends.
So I'm out in the Limpopo province of South Africa, not far from Kruger National Park. I'm working at the Dwarf Mongoose Project, which is set up by Bristol, and they've kindly agreed to let me work with their habituated mongooses out here. I'm actually doing my PhD from the University of Zurich, and I'm looking at vocal communication in mongooses. And at the moment, I'm particularly interested in dwarf mongoose alarm calls.
So can you tell me a little bit about this dwarf mongoose population that's out there?
Yes, the mongooses are wild, but here there are 8 habituated groups. So they've been habituated over time to recognise humans that give specific calls, habituation calls, as non-dangerous. So they'll let us get within a few metres of them and follow them and record their vocalisations and collect all kinds of data that way.
And is it right that you've managed to train them to jump onto balances? Is that right? How does
that
work?
Well, they really like boiled egg. So if we throw a bit of boiled egg into a box that's velcroed to a scale, they will then jump in the box to try and get the egg. And that's how we manage to weigh them.
That's fantastic. So can you tell me a bit about what it's like there in this nature reserve? What's it like when you go outside? What's the scene like?
First of all, we're working on a private reserve, so there's none of the big 5, which means that we can actually walk around the bush on our own without having to worry too much. But there's still the antelope, the giraffe, the amazing bird life that there's out here. Yeah, typically in the morning we'll go out and either look for a dwarf mongoose group or go back to where we know they slept the night before. And then we'll find them and sit with them until they wake up and then follow them for a few hours. Then in summer, which is over here at the moment, it gets too hot and they generally stop foraging, often go back below. So we come back, have lunch, and then go back out in the evening to see them again. And personally, I'm looking at vocal communication with a long-term aim of trying to provide some clues to human language evolution.
So moving on a little bit to Christmas itself, you'll be out in South Africa. What's the plan? Are you going to be out with the mongooses at all?
No, we will be taking a Christmas day off. I'm here with 2 research assistants over Christmas, and we'll be trying to have our own Christmas as much as possible. We're going to make a Christmas dinner and have presents and things like that.
So Christmas can be a great time to get all the family together under one roof. It can be extremely exciting to have the young and the old, everybody together. Or it can be a little bit stressful. But just imagine if your entire family was on a boat. We caught up with Leah LeVay, whose research family are out in the Indian Ocean, where they're doing geological research.
We're on a ship called the Geordie's Resolution. It's part of the International Ocean Discovery Program, which is abbreviated IODP. And we go out on expeditions to drill sediment cores in the seafloor. And so right now we're in the Bay of Bengal, and we're studying the history of the Indian monsoon through geologic time and how it's changed over time.
And so what does your day-to-day activities involve? What do you end up doing on board the ship?
Most of what we do is sediment coring. And so we have a drilling setup, and cores will come up anywhere from 50 minutes to an hour from the sea floor. And on the ship, we have 30 scientists coming from 10 different countries. Who are then studying the cores on the ship, and they're going through different lab protocols and different analyses.
And can you give me a feel for what it's like living on the ship? Is it very sort of close quarters? You know, is it quite cramped? What's it like, the actual environment on board the ship?
The environment is actually pretty nice on the ship. So our drilling operations are 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. to try to get the most science out of the 2 months that we have. So people are working around the clock every day, but the quarters are very nice. People have cabins that they share two to a room. We have an entire catering staff that cooks wonderful meals, does the laundry. It's not hard living.
Fantastic. And so what is Christmas Day looking like? Will you be doing research on Christmas Day?
Well, most likely we will still be coring on Christmas Day. And so people will still have to be working. But we do have Christmas activities planned for Christmas Day. Right now there are Christmas decorations all over the ship. We have two Christmas trees. We have a fake fireplace with stockings. And there's several strands of Christmas lights. But the highlight of Christmas Day is going to be our Christmas program, which will be featuring our Christmas choir that's made up of the ship's crew, some of the technical staff, as well as scientists. They're gonna be singing Christmas carols. There will also be skits featured. And some of our scientists are actually accomplished musicians as well, so they're going to bring out their instruments and play for us.
That was Leah LeVay talking to us from the Indian Ocean. Nicola, which one of those would you go for if you had to spend Christmas at one of those sites?
I quite fancy building a snowman in Antarctica, I have to say. I think that would definitely put the jingle bells on Christmas.
I quite like the idea of being up in Greenland, actually, because it's going to be so dark all the time that all the houses filled with all the lights and everything. It sounded properly Christmassy to me. So I think I'd probably end up in Greenland. Let's turn our attention to 2015. Robin, what's looking good for next year on the science realm?
Several things. CERN has had its Large Hadron Collider been switched off for the great layoff, as it were. And it's due to start firing its first beams round the collider in March, and will go to unprecedented new energies. It's been running at maximum 4 TeV, trillion electron volts per beam. It will now go up to 6.5 TeV a beam. You'll get 13 TeV collisions. You're going to get some really massive bangs there. And out of that, make more Higgs bosons, study the Higgs boson, see what's going on there, but probably really push our try and understanding of supersymmetry. Will we get supersymmetrical particles? And if we do start to get supersymmetrical particles, could they be the cause of dark matter? A lot of hopes. And they say that once they get going in May, they should, you know, have a lot of data coming in. It's a lot more data than they were getting in the past. And at the end of the year, we could have some very interesting science coming out of there.
What if in the next run of the LHC, they find nothing?
They say that just won't happen. But I mean,
it'd be very interesting.
Okay. They say they will find something. They've got, you know, a half a dozen candidates, but they don't have enough data on it. When they run this thing through, one of them is going to give their shoot of it. But wow, if they get nothing, that's going to be very, very embarrassing.
Should we have a bet? I'm in the mood for a bet. Should we have 20 quid?
20 quid.
I'll bet 20 quid.
They find nothing.
CERN find nothing new to physics. So nothing as in new particles.
Yeah.
And before the start of 2017.
You're confident Astor'll be here, are you?
This is the most reckless bet I've ever made.
I'll take you.
Okay, you right. Should.
Yes, yeah, sure,
it's a stupid bet.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
In space, of course, there's the New Horizons mission. It's going to be reaching the Pluto system, so it's going to be looking at Pluto, its moons, checking out what's going on there, looking at the composition of the surface of Pluto and its satellites. So it's quite exciting stuff. It's going to be lots of new data coming from that.
The interesting thing was that when it was launched 9 years ago, it was being launched at the ninth planet. Since it's been there, and the planet's now been degraded, it's no longer a planet, and it's rather sort of derisively called, it was just a dwarf planet, which drives the guys at New Horizon absolutely up the wall.
It's not what they signed up for, was it?
They signed up to go to a planet, and then when they get halfway there, nah, it's not really a planet after all, which must piss them for the lumps. But it's going to be interesting. And then, of course, when it finishes that, it zooms through the Pluto moon, Pluto and its moons, and then heads out into the Kuiper Belt, which is kind of full of all these kind of dwarf planets and studies. study them. So it's another great project.
And we'll be hearing from New Horizons fairly soon in the new year, right?
It's just woken up and it's kind of scratching itself and kind of thinking of getting out of bed, and it'll start chatting to us in the new year.
Middle of January, 15th or so, I think.
And it gets things July the 14th, it gets to its target. Yeah. So, I mean, it's got a lot of good fun science there.
And a bit on climate change as well next year, we hope.
Yes, I mean, well, if we don't get some good stuff on climate change, we're really up, you know, shit creek without a paddle. There has to be a binding agreement from Paris as of the end of, you know, this time next year. And that really has to find a way of cutting carbon emissions so that the globe does not go through a 2 degrees Celsius rise in temperature as of the start of the Industrial Revolution. We've already had about 0.8 of a degree. So, you know, the world's got to work hard not to get that 2 degree rise, which, if it happens, brings in all sorts of other problems. And, you know, we're definitely facing an overheated world then.
Nice finish on an up note, isn't it, Robin? Thanks for that. And that's all we have for you this week. A big thanks to Robin McKee and Nicola Davis, and to all the scientists who spoke to us from around the world. From me, Ian Sample, and all the science team, thanks for listening, and have a great Christmas.